So this is Tom and Annie doing Emily Dickinson's poetry, and we're starting an audio tape.
We're starting an audio tape, and so here are the programs for it. And we'll just start it, and then we can go over what the poems are.
Exactly.
Well, you're going to be recording your own tape, is that what you're doing?
No, we're just playing the tape that we played yesterday, but now it's adequate.
I thought maybe you two were doing some reading.
They tape all these sessions, so.
We're on tape. You thought when we were having all that disgraceful discussion the other day about ménage à trois, etc. I was kidding, we're on tape. So whatever you said, may live alone on the street of regret.
A celebration of the poetry of Emily Dickinson.
Is wholesome even for the king. But God be with the clown who ponders this tremendous scene, this wild experiment of green, as if it were his own. You know that you were due. The frogs got home last week, or settled and at work. Birds, mostly back. The clover warm and thick. You'll get my letter by the 17th. Reply. Or better, be with me. Yours, Fly. The bobolink is gone, the rowdy of the meadow, and no one swaggers now but me. The Presbyterian birds can now resume the meeting he boldly interrupted that overflowing day when, supplicating mercy in a portentous way, he swung upon the Decalogue and shouted, "Let us pray!"
Down on the back of the
I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb when one who died for truth was laying in an adjoining room. He questioned softly why I failed. For beauty, I replied, and I for truth. Themselves are one. We brethren are, they said. And so, as kinsmen met at night, we talked between the rooms until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our names. Tunes I knew and more. 'Twasn't contained like other stanza. No one could play it the second time, but the composer, perfect Mozart, perish with him that keyless rhyme. So children told how brooks in Eden bubbled a better melody, quaintly infer Eve's great surrender, urging the feet that would not fly. Children grown up are wiser, mostly. Eden, a legend, dimly told. Eve, an anguish, rundown story. But I was telling a tune I heard. Not such a strain the church baptizes when the last saint goes up the aisles. Not such a stanza splits the silence when the redemption strikes her bells. Let me not spill its smallest cadence, humming for promise when alone, humming until my faint rehearsal drop into tune around the throne.
Opinion is a flitting thing, but truth. Opinion is a flitting thing. Change it. Opinion is a flitting thing, but truth outlasts the sun. If then we cannot own them both, possess the oldest one.
Now that is understandable.
Oh, so?
What is it? What does it mean?
So what does it mean?
Well, it doesn't have to be paraphrased. It's perfect the way it is.
Well, let's take it just line by line.
Sure, opinion is a flitting thing.
My opinion, her opinion, her opinion.
Okay. But truth outlasts the sun.
If it's true, it's true. Forever.
Yeah. Yeah. Never changes.
Yeah.
If it's the truth.
And it's the same. That's the way it is, that's the way it is.
But it's the same at night as it will be during the day, and the sun's going to be out during the day.
Right, right. Okay. Also, which I think, I mean, it seems to me that we've found a lot this week about days and nights.
Right, because it only hits the top of the mountains here, doesn't it? But you think it's very dark still.
Yeah, but in the poems, our whole problem with the ball, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If then we cannot own them both, possess the oldest one.
Well, that's pretty simple, right?
So, is there a question that is begged here?
Yes. What? Sure. Well, it is, but it isn't. What? Which is the oldest?
Yeah, which is the oldest?
Which is the oldest?
Or the older?
I guess truth would have to be the oldest. It came before.
Yeah, I think that
before man.
I think truth outlasts the sun, suggests it's...
It came before man.
It was and is now and ever shall be.
Right.
So, but there's another, it seems to me, a very basic question that's begged.
Truth outlasts. Choose the oldest one.
Up there?
Opinion is a flitting thing, but truth outlasts the sun. If then we cannot own them both, possess the oldest one.
Okay.
Assumed you can't own both of them.
Yeah, so you can't own both. Let's assume.
Oh.
But opinion could also be the truth.
Pardon me?
Opinion could also be the truth.
Whose opinion?
Isn't that what... part where you said opinion?
Yeah, but whose opinion?
Well, your opinion or...
Right, you got it. My opinion is the truth. Your opinion.
You're rather opinionated.
Another matter. So the question that's begged, it seems to me, is whose truth?
Huh.
Whose truth? Or, to phrase it another way, who's to say what the truth is?
Well, that's interesting.
Is it something you have to prove? It can be proven?
Well, I don't know, but remember we were talking yesterday about Emerson's lines that Dickinson Shirley read, because she was one of the people that she really read. Mm-hmm. Emerson's lines, we can have either truth or repose. Choose what you will, you can never have both. So now we have truth and repose, which are really quite different from truth and opinion,
mm-hmm.
aren't they?
But if I say to you, I have four children, am I telling the truth?
Oh, well, that's a fact. It's either a fact or it's not.
Oh, okay.
But so we'll accept that.
But facts have to be.
If you have a grasp on reality that's firm, then we can accept that you have four children.
Well, from moment to moment, I'm not sure. I mean,
well, now you've got us doubting that you have four children.
See, but I can prove that I do. That's
That you could prove that you have.
Yeah.
Right?
So that's what was my point about making truth a proof, that you would have proof.
Yeah, but if you
it's
said
not
to
an
us.
Opinion.
My children are the best children a mother ever had. Then we would know that we would take that with a grain of salt, wouldn't we? If you said, on the other hand, my children are really virtuous people, then we'd say, well, tell us more. How can we judge that in a more objective way? Or is that your opinion? You seem to be making a pretty flat statement. But is that your opinion as a mother, or what? If we're talking about opinion, then we're talking about my slant on things, mm-hmm. which may or may not be in conflict with your slant on things.
That's true.
Right? So and. Plus the fact that our opinions can change.
Yes.
Your opinion might change. You might think they're virtuous today, and then tomorrow you say, now I remember how
they used
to... I
think the older we get, the more things change. I mean, I see that constant flow in my life. I don't always have the same opinion week to week.
The older I get, the more things I'm uncertain about.
Right. Oh.
Me too.
Yeah.
I'm not.
Really?
The less I know.
Yeah, the less I know that I'm certain about.
There's much to know.
And it's fortuitous that I happen to mention parenting, talking about your children or my children, but the thing that I get less certain about than anything else is parenting. I mean, right. I feel that I have learned some things in life.
Yeah.
This is kind of parenthetical, yeah. But I really do feel that I have learned some things and I could teach somebody something. But I would genuinely not pretend to be able to teach a young person about parenting.
But I have to wait with my children, who are now parents, to be asked. I don't like to give an opinion. See, now that you know all the answers, nobody's ever going to ask you the question.
Do you have all the answers?
but we like to think we do.
But my point is I really don't. I mean, you and I must talk privately so that I can get some answers.
Well, I learned a lot because I have been a high school teacher. You certainly do learn from your students.
I think you learn more teaching than you do parenting.
You had to learn to go with the flow and never be shocked or surprised at anybody's appearance or language, etc., but we could talk about those things.
But I don't know that the things cross-fertilized in my case, they may have done in yours, because I was a teacher at the time that I was being a parent, too, and my kids were coming along, but I don't necessarily feel that I was a better parent because of that. I don't know how good a parent I was.
I was really more broad-minded. That's my point.
But is that necessarily good?
Yes.
Is that opinion or is that true?
No, it's true. It's true to me. It opened horizons to me that I didn't know existed.
That brings up the question when you say, it's true for me. That's all the truth is. You can only speak of your own experience, and then that is your truth.
Which makes this poem a little more interesting, doesn't it?
See, I mean,
thank you. Great.
Isn't that?
It's absolutely true if I know it's true. And it may not even be true to her at all, but it's true for me. It's different than an opinion.
Oh, really?
See if we could have
a concrete example.
Yeah. I'll think about it.
Okay, you think about it, and I will simply rephrase the question that I think is begged here.
All right.
The question is, opinion is a flitting thing, but truth outlasts the sun. If then we cannot own them both, possess the oldest one, how do we know the difference? How does one know the difference?
It's what works for us, the truth.
Well,
it could be what works in our life.
Something could work and not be the truth. You're right. How are we going to know?
I have an entirely different interpretation of the poem.
Let's have it.
Well, I have. It's always been very clear to me too, but it's so different. I've assumed that the opinion is the equivalent of fame, so it's opinion, other people's opinion. So, you know, this is the Andy Warhol's 15 minutes of fame, Emily Dickinson's Andy Warhol's 15 minutes of fame poem. So opinion is a flitting thing, just meaning fame is ephemeral, it comes and goes. But truth outlasts the sun, and I think she felt that when she was really working well, that she was writing truth. In other words, the high-quality work will last. If you can't have both of them, if you can't do your best work and also be rich and famous, then go for the oldest one. So, see, my idea is quite different.
So opinion, in that interpretation, is the world's opinion.
The world's opinion, right.
Mm-hmm. Reputation.
Reputation. The bubble reputation.
The bubble reputation. Yeah.
But then you're saying she puts herself as an authority on truth.
Well, the truth is her work. And sticking to her.
To what comes out of her.
Yeah, and
honoring her own inner journey.
Yeah.
So this would be, in that interpretation, Annie, another rejection poem, rejecting fame, rejecting publishing her poems, subjecting herself to the judgment of critics and publishers and readers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So she had the sense then, by this interpretation, going back to the whole puzzling and fascinating question of why she wasn't published. And there were people urging her to publish. During her lifetime, Helen Hunt Jackson, who was a famous novelist and famous poet, who thought the world of Dickinson's work, wanted her to be published. She wouldn't do it. And the reason why she wouldn't do it is one of the mysteries. But certainly the idea would be that she knew enough about the way the world works to know that if she were to accept to be published, she would be mysterious. I like this first quote, Germain here. She said one time, she wrote to Higginson, who was her mentor, "All men say what to me?"
Mm-hmm.
Whenever people heard her speak or responded to her letters, even Helen Hunt Jackson did it, wrote back to her and said, "What in the world are you saying to me here in this mm-hmm. letter? I don't have any idea." Dickinson would never respond then. Just, "I told you what I think and the way I feel, and that's it. I'm not going to..."
Well, then that was sort of fear of rejection, wasn't it, on her part, that she wouldn't publish?
Yeah. Books. Oh, yeah. Certainly was fear of rejection in part. And it was... And indeed, then when her poems were published, they had to be changed because they were too far out, they were too radical, they were too crazy, they didn't have any rhymes, the rhythms were spasmodic, to use her word. You think my gait's spasmodic. I'm not sure you used the word spasmodic, but she said to him, "You think my gait's spasmodic? I have no tribunal. When you tell me that my poems are too spasmodic, I don't have any tribunal." But her judgment was right in that then there were changes made and some poems were rejected outright, and it was only in 1955, and she died in 1886, in 1955, before the body of her poetry came out as she had written it and left it in her bureau drawer when she died. It took that long for that far out, zany, gnomic, individualistic poetry could be taken by the public for what she wanted it to be taken, namely her words and the order in which she wrote them, with her dashes in between words. And she had the sense not to want to subject herself to that during her lifetime. So in a way, this is another one of those poems.
Yeah,
going through that.
I mean, I just always assumed it was that way. And indeed, that's why we really sort of repeated it. This is a radio program that I helped produce for the 100th anniversary of her death. I directed it, and...
That's what we've been listening to.
So, yeah, so this is just a tape of the radio program, which is a National Public Radio program. So we were doing, it was a sort of... "Auntie, this is my letter to the world" poem.
Mm-hmm.
And we put it
mm-hmm.
in.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried to choose all poems that responded to having this kind of musical accompaniment to help clarify them.
And it's a perfectly acceptable interpretation.
Yeah.
It's
interesting.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. It is. One of the fascinating things about her poems is that they are so chock full and concise. One may read them and interpret them quite differently from one year to the next. I've picked up a poem that I have liked for a certain reason and have taught several times. And I've picked the poem up and I've said, "My goodness, I've had that poem wrong all along." Or a student will ask a question, and I will think, "Well, that's a dumb question. I don't say that. I'm smart enough not to say that." My thought is, "God, goodness, what a screwy interpretation that is that would prompt that kind of question." And the more I've thought about it, the more it has seemed to me to be the question to ask about a given poem. So it's the richness of the poetry is its metaphor, which can be interpreted so often in different ways.
Yeah, so I had never thought of this interpretation. That's interesting. Should we just go briefly over the other poems on the tape? They're not necessarily the best known poems.
On the contrary, they're not the best known poems.
They're not the best known.
Part of the charm of the program is that there are a conventional list of a dozen poems that one could pick and one could read, and everyone would say, sure, okay. I mean, not everyone, but people who like Dickinson would say, hooray, that's peachy. But Annie read a letter yesterday to the group from Richard Sewell, who is the god of critics, who wrote this two-volume biography of Dickinson, which is just a magnificent biography. Really first class. And he also edited this very provocative and well done edition of Essays, 20th Century Views. This is a very good series if you don't happen to know it, but it's a series of very good collections of essays on the best American writers. And not just American, started with American, now it includes, well, a friend of ours, close friend of ours, did the one on Cervantes, for example. So it's just pulling together from over a long period of time and with very different opinions, critics' reactions to Dickinson. And I've used this book for 30 years. Really good. And Sewell edited it. So Sewell is the king of the critics. Wonderful man.
So in this note, we send him one of these tapes.
Okay, what was his reaction?
And, it's a dear letter, it's just sweet. And I won't read it again, but I'll show it to you afterwards. He's just such a charming gentleman. He thought the actress overacted too much. He thinks they tend to. And he wants a flatter kind of reading. But he did say it was lovely to be reminded again of the poem Better Than Music, which he had forgotten all about. And he said it was nice to have that come back to
you. Have?
Yes, it's in there, so we'll show it to you. It's stuck in the book, yeah.
Really he nice commented book. About her English accent, too, didn't he?
No, that was actually talking about Frances Sternhagen.
Oh, excuse me. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Luckily, he didn't say anything about Ruth's accent,
all
because
right.
Ruth is terribly self-conscious about it, and apparently it's a sort of American Scottish accent. I don't know what it is. I don't even hear it anymore. So I'm glad he picked on Frances Sternhagen and not my actress.
Who is a Holden actress, by the way. This person who's performed
who's
at Holden
here.
And who really introduced us to Holden. Ruth McCreed.
And so the poems were all chosen so that they would work orally and work on the radio and work with music and the musicians and Ruth and the producer and I sat around and went over. We all went over just hundreds of poems, and we would come with lists, and I mean it was really great fun. and eventually got it down to, I think it's 7 poems.
I made a few suggestions too, none of which was taken. Until I was safe. But perhaps we should just explain, Annie, by way of introduction, that for those of you who weren't with us before, that what's happening here is that I had 5 sessions last week on her poetry, talking about the body of her poetry, talking some about her and her family, you can't avoid that, and her setting, the place where she wrote, New England, she's such a New England person. And then this week we thought that we would talk about the art which her words on the page has inspired, and have seen a videotape about her life, which is a beautiful PBS television program, 1 hour, part of a series about American writers. And we discussed that a bit, and then we were playing this audio tape. We also have a videotape of Emily Dickinson's set to music, which also includes Ruth McCrea reading the poetry, and a colleague of hers and a friend of ours who then sings some of it. But to try to give a sense of the enriching work that's been done by other artists commenting on her life and her work. So that's what we're about this week, Emily Dickinson in performance.
And there is a dance which I meant to look up before we left and did try to look it up at home and couldn't find any material, so I was going to do it at the library and I didn't. I think it's Martha Graham, and I think it's called My Letter to the World, which is one of Emily Dickinson's poems. But I can't bring it to mind, surely. But
it might have been one too many things to try to get in anyway. But
right,
it might have been a way of treating her poetry from the standpoint of dance, but it's been done by a number of choreographers and dancers, we know that, who've taken her poems and set them to music and then danced to them.
It's probably because it's so rich in imagery.
So one of the things that we want to be guided by you in is how much you want us to come back to the poems. And I appreciated your wanting to have a look at this first poem, the poem that we've been discussing. But in the measure that you'd like to have us look at some of the others that intrigue you, we certainly want to do that, not get all the way away from the poems, which are the stuff that we're working with.
So I think we might just go over these that are on the radio program, and then maybe just play the radio program again. It's 8 minutes. And
that might be kind of fun to do.
Just sort of
let's just read the other poems.
Yeah.
Read the poems. And then hear them again, and we can discuss them in the measure that people wish. But maybe it's not necessary to overly discuss.
So the very first poem, which we wanted one that was funny and fun, and that was a grabber. This is our grabber poem, and also it has all kinds of musical possibilities. Is a little madness in the spring is wholesome. Even for the king, capitalized, but God be with the clown who ponders this tremendous scene, this whole experiment of green, as if it were his own. which I just think is a wonderful sort of little instruction not to get carried away with what you think you can do in the world. It's God who makes spring and not you.
But then the clown, to me the clown resonates with reflections which he has in other poems made about the spring or nature really belonging to other creatures, not just to us. And she had a very kind of 1990 view on who owns the field. The field is owned by the field mouse or the snake, not by us. We're just observers, or we share at best the field. So but the clown is a wonderful, wonderful figure.
Well, you know, I mean, it's actually a phrase that people use now. Say, you clown, you know. What kind of clown do you think you are? The next one is very easy. Just choose somebody to read it to. It's a letter.
That one again.
Yeah.
B, I'm expecting you. Was saying yesterday to somebody you know that you were due. The frogs got home last week, are settled and at work. Birds mostly back, the clover warm and thick. You'll get my letter by the 17th. Reply, or better, be with me, yours, Fly. Isn't that cute?
I would rather not read.
Okay. We just have one on a page, so we'll just, because they're all scattered.
She said it so many times.
I've been hearing it all week. Oh, yeah,
great. Great.
I read it to the high school students this morning.
Oh, good. Did they like it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, this one is a little trickier than it seems. The bobolink is gone. Tom says we have a mispronunciation on it. I mean, we said the wrong word on it, so we'll have to say it correctly this time. I don't know the difference between the two words, so I'm going to go and get the dictionary.
Portentous.
Portentous. What's the difference between portentous and portentous? Portentous.
I don't think there is a word portentous.
Oh, there is
a word.
Yes. Older
man. Portentous. Pretentious.
Portentous. Huh? Portentous. You say it's portentous?
That's what it is here.
Get the dictionary.
I'm going to get the dictionary, and we also have to allow the possibility, the slim possibility, that Ruth checked with William Matchett, who is a retired professor at the University of Washington who works on Emily Dickinson texts and may have gotten another word for that line, because she does that. And she often uses his. There are choices of words from various manuscripts and versions. Mm-hmm. So
T-I-O-U-S?
So I'm
going to
go
get it. P-O-R-T-E-N-T-O-U-S.
Portentous.
Portentous.
Portentous is often a mispronunciation of the word portentous.
P-O-U-S.
Yeah.
Portentous.
Yeah.
Shall I read it?
Please.
The bobolink is gone, the rowdy of the meadow, and no one swaggers now but me. The Presbyterian birds can now resume the meeting. He boldly interrupted that overflowing day when supplicating mercy in a portentous way. He swung upon the decalogue and shouted, "Let us pray."
I didn't bring the ox.
That ought to answer everything. There's truth right in your hand.
How about that?
So, who here knows the bobolink? People know the bobolink? It's an eastern bird, it's not a western bird. We don't have it out here.
Okay, it's the Midwest too.
Midwest too, yeah. What? How would you characterize the bird, those of you who know it? Bobolink. Well,
their nests are distinctive, aren't they? They build a little, a different type nest, a bobolink?
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think it's right.
And they're more of a meadow bird?
It is a meadow bird, right. Very definitely, right.
Yes. So they probably were flying off for their winter home.
Yeah, I think they're commenting on this time of year when, as I mentioned to my birders, was anybody with me on the birding trip this morning? That one of the fascinating things that's happening in this village right now is that we are losing the swallows. The swallows, those of you who've been with us even 2 days, day before yesterday, this place was abuzz with swallows. Two species, the barn swallow and the violet green swallow, were all over the village, particularly right over the village center and in this building
so
here.
So they know it's getting cold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they have pretty much left. And that was really dozens and dozens of birds. So it's one of the things that's interesting about the fall is to watch the birds go. And this is a comment on the fact that the bobolink, she had a meadow right next to her house. Mm-hmm. It was right across the street, a big meadow that she could see from her room. And the bobolink is the most bossy, assertive of birds, and you never forget that he's there. He's kind of like a jay. He's not as aggressive as a jay, but he's a very assertive bird.
Noisy
bird, a beautiful bird, by the way, where the jay is. So it's not a bird you're going to forget about. It's a bird that you know is there.
But we don't have them out here, do we?
We do not have them out here.
No.
And I miss them.
So I haven't seen them since I lived in the East. I forgot about them, actually.
Right.
That's
but
terrible.
She calls our memory back to it. It's like an
cardinals
old friend.
Also. She doesn't write about cardinals.
She doesn't write about... Well, she does. She has
does a, she?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. But so he's gone.
Right.
And so she's now saying that there's nobody swaggering but me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a metaphor. She doesn't really swagger, but she imagines that she swaggers, and she certainly swaggers in a sense. What do you think the Presbyterian birds are? Presbyterian birds. Do you think she looks upon the Presbyterian birds favorably? The Presbyterian birds can now resume the meeting, which he boldly interrupted that overflowing day, when, supplicating mercy in a portentous way, he swung upon the Decalogue and shouted, "Let us pray!" in his assertive way. So the Presbyterian birds would be birds much less assertive, much less colorful, much less interesting, rather conventional, rather conservative, rather uninteresting, dare we say? Well, we don't wish to make judgments here, but on the other hand, maybe we have to make judgments. So the bobolink might have been what kind of a bird? Well, let me, at the risk of giving offense here, because I happen, as does Annie, I might say, and I usually don't make a big point of this in Holden Village, but we happen to be members of the one true faith. We are Roman Catholics, and we accept Protestants. Don't misunderstand me. You have a place, you Protestants. But the red cardinal's robe is really the sign of being touched by God. Well, having said that, I would suggest that the bobolink might be perceived as being the RC bird, right? The RC bird, who has really the final answers. As I would humbly advance is the case. So, and with the terrific pomp and ceremony, which some people denigrate, but which we of course know is essential for true worship, we who have the word, and therefore we may be dealing here with a clash between, dare I say it, Catholicism and Protestantism? I think that's a possibility. Now, Emily Dickinson was not a Catholic. Goodness knows. She was not a Catholic. On the other hand, I think she liked color, and she liked pageantry, and she liked fun things. So she might have been doing what I'm doing here, which is kind of kidding the more colorful kind of religious worship vis-a-vis the cold, sparse New England form of worship, which was itself pretty Old Testament oriented, pretty unforgiving, and pretty not much music, none of the color of the Lutheran ceremony with the centrality of great music, which is what we find here at Holden, for example. Now, we find more really good music here at Holden than we ever get in our own parish. At home. I'm not saying that's why we come. I'm not saying that. But it plays a part. Because we love to come and have this great singing and this great music that the Lutherans have, that the Catholics used to have, and we don't know where it went, but it's gone. So we rarely hear it. Very rarely.
I don't see where you get the Catholics and the Protestants in that, though.
Well, I guess I'm saying that she's I'm picking up on her metaphor and kidding her kidding metaphor, which is that the bobolink was the rowdy of the meadows, but then she switches. He's a swaggering bird, like a Catholic pontiff, like the Pope, right? With his Pope mobile.
Yeah, but it just sounds like that you're putting it's your interpretation, of course, but.
Oh, may I read the poem again?
Maybe I can see the Pope or the or a priest.
I think
now.
You can
all
probably
right.
See.
I'm gonna pause it.
Is that No. Wouldn't say that.
I'm gonna pause it that we could say that the good Pope could stand for the bobolink. All right.
Sure. Okay.
Well, opinion or truth now?
The bobolink is gone. The rowdy of the meadow, and no one swaggers now but me. The Presbyterian birds can now resume the meeting. He boldly interrupted that overflowing day when, supplicating mercy in a portentous way, he swung upon the decalogue and shouted, "Let us pray."
The only problem there for me is that the bobolink is not red.
Well, it's colorful. Yeah. Oh, it's a very colorful bird.
Yellow is
the
main color.
Oh, yeah, but I think you're being too literal about the color. The bobolink's a very colorful black and white and tan, which often in the sunlight reads orange.
That's right.
Oh.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Getting closer to being right.
Right. Getting closer to being right.
You're getting closer to being right.
Well, by the time this class is over, you and I will be in total accord on all these
matters. Methodist minister in a black robe. Anyway, it's fun to play with it anyway.
Yeah, it is.
You don't believe it.
Husband is correct on you.
I think it's about portentous. Yeah, yes. I'm afraid he is. So I'm afraid
portentous is right.
That's terrible. Yeah.
It takes one to know one, right?
Spelling, I had to agree. I want T-I-O-U-S.
Right, and there's no such word, and so we've sent out over the airwaves a word which doesn't exist.
Slaughtering.
But it's not unusual. It is not an unusual mispronunciation.
And well,
to the point where I missed it myself. I heard this tape, but it's trial stages. I should have picked it up. That's the second error I've made this year. The second error I've made this year.
I trust you to send some material at all.
Only 9 months.
That's right.
What?
The first error, Robert, should I tell you about the first error? First error was when I thought I had made a mistake, but it turned out I'd been right.
Oh. That's understandable.
This is what I say when students discover an error on the board. When I can get away with that, I say it. But I can only get away with it each class once.
Once a quarter.
Right.
Once a quarter. Right. No, 3 times a quarter because I have 3 different classes.
Oh, yeah.
But I have to be careful if there's a student in the class before, I can't use that.
Well,
line
you also
again.
Have to remember which class you said it in.
Exactly. So I'm inclined not to use it except for the beginning classes.
Which is probably a good idea.
I'm giving away all my secrets here. That's one good thing about being away from home.
We don't have to take your class now because we're getting it here.
Yeah, you are. Good. You are getting it
it's
here.
It's Spanish when you take it, but the jokes are the same.
Well, I get no respect. No respect. But it is a lovely poem. It's a fun poem.
Yeah.
Next one, Ty?
Then the next one is "Opinion is a flitting thing, but truth outlasts the sun. But then we cannot own them both, possess the oldest one." And then the next one is a wonderful one that I don't think any of us knew, and I think the musicians brought it in because they wanted to do the music to it. They just thought it was so appropriate for music, and it's all about a storm. Why don't I just read it? "An awful tempest mashed the air." Great words. "An awful tempest mashed the air. The clouds were gaunt and few. A black," which is capitalized, "as of a specter's cloak," both of which are capitalized, "hid heaven and earth from view." It's just so ominous. "The creatures chuckled on the roofs and whistled in the air and shook their fists and gnashed their teeth and swung their frenzied hair." And I don't think you know what those creatures are. I mean, whether those are just the creatures of your imagination. I mean, they're like gargoyles or something. They're swirling around in this maelstrom. "The morning lit, the birds arose, The monster's faded eyes turned slowly to his native coast, and peace was paradise. When you hear that again, you'll hear how you get this whole storm going and this crazy whirling. It's like a Walpurgis night, or like
a Wagner opera.
Yeah, Night on Bald Mountain, or all this wild stuff going on, and then the peace comes. Really nice. The next one is really hard. But of course we had to choose it because we fell in love with the title, which was Better Than Music. Once having fallen in love with the title, we had to figure out how the poem worked, which is really hard. I'll just tell you my final decision and go through it, and then somebody else can take an attempt at it. My final decision was that this was some sort of music of the spheres. It was some sort of divine sound, that it wasn't earthly music that she's talking about. It was something that is beyond this world that she heard. So I don't know whether that's right or not, but I'll just read it quickly. Better than music, for I who heard it, I was used to the birds before. This was different. This was translation of all tunes I knew, and more. 'Twasn't contained like other stanza. No one could play it the second time. But the composer, and I think that has to go, 'twasn't contained like other stanza. No one could play it the second time but the composer. And then referring to the composer, who was perfect Mozart. And then back to the composer, perish with him that keyless rhyme. So once that composer is gone, that's the end of it. Nobody else can play it again. It can't be repeated. It's very complicated stuff. So children told how brooks in Eden bubbled a better melody. So children told about Eden and how much better Eden was than now. Quaintly infer, children infer, just from that story of the garden, Eve's great surrender. And the great surrender is urging the feet that would not fly. So, in other words, children, you know, just looking at a picture of the Garden of Eden, come up with the whole story. Children matured are wiser, mostly. We've been discussing that. Eden, a legend, dimly told. Eve and the anguish, granddam's story. But I was telling a tune I heard, so that's just, but you know, when you grow up, the whole story of Eden fades away and just becomes an old wives' tale. And then she just takes you back into, but I was telling a tune I heard. But I was telling you about this music that I heard. Not such a strain the church baptizes. The church doesn't come up with such great music. When the last saint goes up the aisles, and there's some actually specific reference that is to, and I can't remember what it is. I think maybe Ruth came up with that because she's much more liturgically knowledgeable than I am. Where you have some sort of procession and have some music carrying it, you know, being the last of the procession, but I can't remember what that is. Not such a strain the church baptizes when the last saint goes up the aisles. Not such a stanza splits the silence when the redemption strikes her bells. You don't even get this music when you have the bells ringing. Let me not spill its smallest cadence. Don't let me lose a bit of it. Humming for promise when alone. I just take that as I'm keeping it inside of me by myself in anticipation of the future. For promise being an anticipation of the future. Humming until my faint rehearsal. I'm just going to go on humming it until this rehearsal time of mine is over and drop into tune around the throne. Until I no longer am rehearsing, but I actually get to sing the song in heaven around the throne.
That's good.
But it's really it's a tough one.
You know what it reminds me of? I mean, it's a much more sophisticated version of while sitting alone at the organ, I was weary and ill at ease, and my fingers wandered idly over the noisy keys. I know not what I was playing, nor what I was thinking of, but I struck one chord of music like the sound of a great harmony. The lost chord.
That's a lot easier.
It's a lot easier. But
why don't we just use that?
You're choosing repose rather than truth.
Yes.
See, and having lived in Louisiana, I immediately thought of when the saints come marching home.
It resonated in there for me too a bit. Yeah.
You mean the saints go marching in?
Yeah.
Yeah, when the saints come marching in.
It's my
same song.
Same song. Sure.
Thank you.
Came through my
head.
I'll be
your
number when the saints go marching.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's the last one. And then we go back and do the truth one again.
Yeah, and then it's also I Died for Beauty. So would somebody like to read that, because that one we actually know.
You
want to
read I Died for Beauty?
Yeah, but somebody else could do this, I think, equally. Just wonderfully well.
I think we can have two people.
Come over, because it can be a dialogue.
No, I don't care to.
Okay. Why don't you dialogue?
Yeah, you two do dialogue. So you're the thief. And you'll see. You'll come to.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb when one who died for truth was lain in an adjoining room.
He questioned softly why I failed.
For beauty, I replied.
And I for truth, themselves are one. We brethren are, he said.
And so as kinsmen met a night, we talked between the rooms until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our names.
I think that one's clear. And the music in this one is wonderful. And they just did, the musicians did great things in getting this kind of...
Yeah. There's just one little cutie on here I have to read. I love it. Not at home to callers, said Seneca Tree. Bought it due in April, wishing you good day. Yeah, I mean, so far afield from what we're doing here.
This poem, I Died for Beauty, was one of three that I read at Vespers one night before. I think most of you were here. Betty, I think you may have heard it, which are poems that are written as from the dead, how it was when death took place, how it was before I died, which was kind of a wonderful, she has a wonderful series of poems that way, imagining oneself in the next world, looking back to the process of dying in several cases of which this is one, or how it was last year when I died, if I were to come back now, how it would be. She had that wonderful leap of the imagination as to how the world will seem once we are beyond the world. Shall we play this again now?
Let's play it once more.
Let's just hear them.
I think it'll be fun, and some people have come in late and you might want to have a row for them. Follow the players. And I do commend listening to these amazing things the two musicians came up with their room full of instruments.
So it takes 8 minutes, Annie, and you said how long you spent, you all spent 20 plus hours in a studio time, with Annie the director, the player Ruth, and the two musicians putting this program together.
And the engineer and the producer. The producer was actually a radio producer, and so she was the one who would have the final decision on whether it was actually, the quality was good enough to be for broadcast.
Made for in 1986.
Bailey Music, a celebration of the poetry of Emily Dickinson.
Experiment of green as if it were his own. Bee, I'm expecting you. Was saying yesterday to somebody you know that you were due. The frogs got home last week, or settled and at work. Birds, mostly back, the clover warm and thick. You'll get my letter by the 17th. Reply. Or better, be with me. Yours, Fly. The bobolink is gone, the rowdy of the meadow, and no one swaggers now but me. The Presbyterian birds can now resume the meeting he boldly interrupted that overflowing day when, supplicating mercy in a portentous way, he swung upon the decalogue and shouted, "Let us pray!" Oldest one. An awful tempest mashed the air. The clouds were gaunt and few. A black as of a specter's cloak hid heaven and earth from view. The creatures chuckled on the roofs and whistled in the air and shook their fists and gnashed their teeth and swung their frenzied hair. The morning lit. The birds arose. The monster's faded eyes turned slowly to his native coast. And peace was paradise. I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb when one who died for truth was lain in an adjoining room. He questioned softly why I failed. For beauty, I replied, and I for truth. Themself are one. We brethren are, they said. And so, as kinsmen met at night, we talked between the rooms until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our names. Tunes I knew and more. 'Twasn't contained like other stanza. No one could play it the second time, but the composer, perfect Mozart, perish with him that keyless rhyme. So children told how brooks in Eden bubbled a better melody, quaintly infer Eve's great surrender, urging the feet that would not fly. Children grown up are wiser, mostly. Eden, a legend, dimly told. Eve and the anguish, from dumb story. But I was telling a tune I heard. Not such a strain the church baptizes when the last saint goes up the aisles. Not such a stanza splits the silence when the redemption strikes her bells. Let me not spill its smallest cadence, humming for promise when alone, humming until my faint rehearsal drop into tune around the throne.
Better Than Music was produced for KUO. OOW by the Center for Public Media.
So, Ruth McCree and a professional singer colleague of hers then subsequently did a program which we find very intriguing and refreshing of a person narrating poems, Ruth, and her colleague then singing not the same poems, but other poems. And the treatment of the poems, it seems to me, is respectful and illuminating, because you sense more in the poems when you hear them sung or hear them read than you can in just taking them off the page.
So we have one set, and they did this in concert at Williams College in Massachusetts, the Clark Art Institute. And we have one section, I think it's the third section that we have, which is just a black and white videotape of a dress rehearsal. But I thought it might be fun to play, because then you just get an idea of what several different musicians have done with Emily Dickinson poems. And also you get some more poems read by Ruth McCree, which is kind of fun. So I think it's that section. So I'll just stick it in and we'll see what we've got. With apologies.
Oh, some of them will be the same, won't they?
Some of them will be the same. And this is not a professional tape. It's the camera just stays in one place and it's a dress rehearsal with one person applauding.
Mm-hmm. Applauding?
One person applauding, yes.
Mm-hmm.
The husband of the singer is head of
the music. Oh, we get it. I thought you meant before me.
So he applauds. We can applaud. Mm-hmm.
I don't know where that turns
off. The sound of one hand clapping, huh?
The sound of one hand clapping.
The look of death. Not at home to callers, says the naked tree. Jacket due in April. Bidding you good day. Longing is like the seed that rustles in the ground, believing if it intercede, it shall at length be found. The hour and the clime, each circumstance unknown. What constancy must be achieved before it see the sun? Nature is what we see. The hill, the afternoon, squirrel eclipse, the bumblebee. Nay, nature is heaven. Nature is what we hear. The bobolink, the sea, thunder, the cricket. Nay, nature is harmony. Nature is what we know, yet have no art to say. So impotent our wisdom is to her sincerity. A little madness in the spring is wholesome even for the king. But God be with the clown who ponders this tremendous scene, this wild experiment of green, as if it were his own.
Can you think of it? I mean,
earth has many keys. Where melody is not is the unknown peninsula. Beauty is nature's fact. A witness for her land and witness for her sea. The cricket is her utmost of elegy to me. In the road alone and doesn't care about careers and exigencies never fears, whose coat of elemental brown a passing universe put on, and independent as the sun associates or glows alone, fulfilling absolute decree in casual simplicity.
Ruth, the actress, work with somebody in interpretation, or is this your own?
With me.
Oh,
yeah. Right. Well, so that's Tom's yours.
Was this a performance on stage, or was it a TV?
Yeah, no, it was a performance on stage at Williams College.
Because Cameron never moved.
No, so this was just a dress rehearsal.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was partly just so I would have a record of what they did.
Yeah,
and because I was here on the West Coast. And also to have a kind of, well, a little piece to see about getting it booked other places so it could be shown how it works. Because it's quite unusual to do this, to have poetry and music together that way. And indeed, it's so unusual we haven't been able to get anybody else to book it because people say, well, we don't know whether the music department or the lecture department should do this, whether it should be the concert committee or the lecture committee. So,
sure.
You know. The English department.
Yeah, you know. Somebody will want it sometime.
Speech communication.
Yeah.
Right. Then you start saying, well,
speech communication doesn't have enough clout on this campus, I'm afraid. And then they look askance on music, you see, because music is, well, it's, music is nice, you understand. I like Duke Ellington as well as the next person, but it's not quite the word, if you take the meaning. It's not quite the word.
Great enough.
Yeah.
But I thought they were wonderful together, and two such interestingly contrasting women, because Elizabeth Söderberg, the singer, is a wonderful singer, and it's just an incredible voice. Is as a the persona that she projects is very cerebral and very cool, and the persona, and she was all there in that stark white dress, handsome woman, black hair, and Ruth's persona is all warm and all spirit, so it was very interesting to have the two.
But then visually the black.
And all in black, yeah.
It's sort of like a black and white laundry on this.
Yeah.
Well, and then the accompanist in black and white, did you notice?
Yeah.
And she's fair.
Yeah.
She's fair, so it's really a lovely composition.
Yeah, and that nice rug, I mean, it really looked lovely.
Yeah, it's all very symmetrical.
I have a friend who's a singer who looked at it and said, oh dear, I just hate to see singers having to move when actors are moving on the same stage because the actors move better than the singers. But I think that was definitely just a singer's reaction. I thought it was an interesting program.
Here's a good thing, it reminds me of Dominic Gargantua's play Alice in Wonderland and the Turtle Talk. And the singing is much like the
Oh, really?
It's just like I was hearing it. Like
Oh, that's interesting.
The whole conversation between,
the carpenter and the
walrus.
The walrus. Yeah. The walrus and the carpenter.
Well, I think we might call it a day at that point. We have a final kind of wrap-up session on Saturday, for those of you who will be here Saturday morning, when we'll try to recapitulate and maybe do something more with these poems that we have not had a chance to go over, particularly if you'd like to. We have here books for your delectation and delight again, if you'd like to look at any of them, and we'll be here to talk as long as anybody would like to, but I think now we'll declare that these proceedings are closed. As Douglas MacArthur said at the surrender of Japan, the Missouri battleship, these proceedings are closed. A rather portentous way to close this particular episode.